Hello and welcome to Out of the Frame, conversations about photography. I'm Pia Johnson, your host, and this podcast features conversations about photography, creativity, and the world we live in. I'll be talking to other photographers, curators, academics, and researchers about their work, artistic process, and how they feel about contemporary photography. Today's episode of Out of the Frame, Conversations About Photography, was recorded on the lands of the Dja Dja Wurrung country. I'd like to acknowledge traditional owners of the land that we live, work, create, and thrive on, the people of the Kulin Nation. I pay respects to their elders, past and present. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land. My guest today is Leslie Turnbull, who is a Scottish-Australian artist and teacher with a research-based art practice that investigates photo-based practices, performance, creative writing, and sculpture to explore how marginalisation shapes personal narratives and lived experiences. Central to her work are recurring themes of memory, place, and time, often represented through obscured images and foggy landscapes taken in Scotland, which she refers to as queered perspectives. These perspectives are characterised by often blurred and distorted images that emerge from her experimental photographic approach. Leslie's photographic practice also focuses on portraiture, exploring identity in relation to sexuality and gender, with a particular interest in the Western cultural narrative surrounding the tomboy. Through her research, she discovered a significant erasure of tomboy narratives beyond childhood. In response, she created a series of projects that examine tomboy experiences from childhood through adolescence to various stages of adulthood, aiming to illuminate this aspect of female experience and bring it into focus. Her work has been exhibited in Australia, Germany, Iceland, China, and the UK. Leslie won the Melt Prize for Portraiture in 2017 and the Midsummer Australia Post Award in 2018, and has been shortlisted for various awards, including the Head On Portrait Prize. She has also received commissions and funding from the Victoria Arts Council to conduct research in Iceland and Scotland. Through an interdisciplinary creative approach, her work combines theoretical analysis with studio-based methodologies that emphasize experimentation. Leslie engages with social and political discourses by examining archives, aiming to provoke critical reflection and dialogue. By investigating the historical context of specific places, Leslie strives to uncover layers of meaning that deepen our understanding of ourselves and the societies we inhabit. Hi, Leslie. Thank you so much for joining us today. I thought we would begin by asking you how you started your journey in photography.
Oh, hello, Pia. Hi, thanks. Well, first of all, it's an honour and a pleasure. Thanks very much for inviting me to your incredible podcast. Been enjoying it. My journey, I suppose, in photography started back when I was a teenager. It's had a lot of kind of stops and starts, but I think, yeah, the first thing that comes to mind is sort of at that sort of age, you know, I left school quite early. I left school about 15, and I remember just feeling really sort of lost. Like, I didn't really have any friends. I didn't know what I was doing, which has kind of followed me around a bit, but that's another story. I had my bike and I had my Walkman and I had an Instamatic camera, a wee camera, but it had a, you know, I could kind of throw it over me. I remember I used to wear it across my body, you know, because I had like a sort of piece of string in it or something. It was just a little camera. I don't know where I got this camera. I think it might be Manti Leslie, because she seemed to have stuff, you know, that lying around. She always had things. So she might have given it to me. Anyway, and what I would do is sort of, you know, I'm from a, you know, Leith, which is very urban, very gritty, great place. But I would take my bike though, and I would just want to get out. It was like a sense of escape. So I'd like plug into my music, you know, it'd be David Bowie or Joni Mitchell, like a awesome. Really weird mix, you know, Joan Armatrading, of course, you know, and all that
excellent
kind of stuff.
Mix. Yeah.
And I would just ride off onto along the coast to these kinds of other industrial sites, like sort of defunct spaces, you know, yeah. And I'd sort of just explore. So that was the sort of beginning. And I would set the camera up. And interestingly, I'd be like, set it up on a, you know, just sit it down. And there was a wee self timer thing on this thing. So you could like just take pictures of yourself, you know, but I was always taking pictures of myself, kind of looking away, you know, as if the camera wasn't there, you know, that sort of thing. And so I must have been taking pictures of other things, but I don't remember at that point. Anyway, but it was about the experience, I think, just the sense of like adventure and going off and having like a pal, almost sort of the music and the camera, you know, something to do, like an activity or something like that. So it's kind of linked to being outdoors and a bit of adventure, bit of escape. But like later on, so, you know, leaving school young, I sort of, you know, started to figure out what I was trying to do here. And I, you know, I got random jobs. There wasn't really much in the way of kind of, you know, I didn't have a linear process here. You know, it wasn't like, Leslie, maybe you should do this. There was no sort of conversation. So I didn't even think about career. It's something that I've never thought about in that realm. It's sort of interesting. And then in my early 20s, you know, sort of late teens, I started studying welfare, but that's important because that comes later. And I sort of didn't finish that, but then I went into photography early teens. And I think really because it was quite fashionable at that time. Like everyone seemed, you know, it was the 80s and photography was kind of cool, you know?
Okay.
And there were magazines like The Face or Interview or those sorts of large format, glossy, you know, and there were always kind of like edgy kind of images, you know? But yeah, and a lot of my friends around me were sort of starting to go to art school. And I didn't think about that for myself, but I went to like a TAFE, I suppose. Like it's a college over there. And I started studying like a degree foundation course.
Okay.
And it was photography. It was called an AV course.
Okay.
And so it was audio visual, right?
Yeah.
So it was all analog and these sorts of things. But also there was like a film component, which is sort of funny because, you know, when I was making these films on VHS video, these big massive cameras that you're cumbersome wandering around with, you know, but I'd set up these like scenarios. And I made this short film about, you know, a woman who's like a drug addict, you know, like who just like, you know, and so I had my friend who was dead skinny and waif-like. So I had her eat Heinz tomato soup, you know, and kind of throw up out of herself, you know. And I would sit there with a camera and I just remember being so close in, like in the Zoom.
Oh, wow.
And then when we put the work together, we saw it and we looked at it and she's like, this isn't a film, Leslie. This is just a series of stills, you know.
Wow. So, already had that insight.
Yeah. So it was very much just these close-ups and these stills. So it was photography was something that kind of was grabbing me at that point, you know, rather than me grabbing it. So, and the portraits I was starting to develop then, you know, I remember just a pinnacle moment before we move on is that I still remember a lecturer saying to me, a teacher, you know, at this, because this was a TAFE, right? It's a college. And it was very kind of work-based, you know, and you're producing a lot of things. But they did introduce you to sort of like mood, I suppose. And I would take these portraits and they were always dead dark, you know, at this point.
Yeah, okay.
They were like really, really shadowy and dark and kind of high contrast, you know. That was the sort of thing. It was like HP, you know, 4 film, like grainy stuff. And yeah, they would ask me, why was I taking these portraits? And I remember just thinking, why are they asking me this? You know, like, I just, you know, I couldn't really get my head around that sort of, these sorts of conceptual underpinnings at that point. I just remember thinking, well, you know, I just like it. You know, it was just this sort of, I just enjoy this sort of aesthetic or something, you know. And it would have been years later that those sorts of, you know, underpinnings to photography began to really interest me. Yeah. And that's when things took off for me.
Yeah. So how old were you then? Like when you actually really did turn your, I guess, mind, but also creativity to photography?
Yeah. Well, I think it's important for me to say there's a lot of kind of blanks during my 20s, a lot of blank spots, just because of what was going on in my life, you know. It can be a tumultuous time. Yeah, there was a lot of personal things going on during that time.
Well, I think it's a very definitive time to your 20s. You know, I think you're kind of forging identity, trying to work out your space, relationships. You know, I'm not surprised that there, and I think it's quite interesting the way you're saying that there are gaps or, you know, kind of maybe episodic things, because I feel like that works, that speaks very well to, you know, some of the work that we will talk about a bit later.
Totally.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But also to that formative things of the dark that you were talking about in those really early moments. And I guess, you know, it's really exploratory and really organic in a way as a teenager into your 20s. But yeah, I always wonder if there is a turning point or just something that kind of sparks it, like, actually, yes, it's photography.
Yes, totally.
Did that happen to you?
It did. And again, it sort of is linked to this sort of journey through the 20s. But then what happened was I left and came to Australia when I was in my late 20s. And it was almost, we call it a geographical, you know, there's that term, and it's the sense of just getting away from where you are and going somewhere else, right? There was no sort of planning, you know, but I always had a camera up here. Like, yeah. I had an FG20 that I bought when I went to college, right? It's like an amateur Nikon, right? But it's a gorgeous looking wee camera, right? It's so beautiful. And I've still got that camera.
Yeah.
And I still use it. But anyway, so, you know, I had this sense of, you know, that I sort of had this sort of idea somewhere that I was going to be a photographer, but it was always just somewhere over there, you know? And so when I got to, and it's funny because it kind of was over there, because when I got to Australia, you know, my life kind of hit a rock bottom, actually. And what happened is I got into recovery. And this is important because there was a crossroads in my life when I was in my mid-30s. And at that stage, you know, when I was studying welfare in my late teens, I was now working as a youth worker. I was, you know, running a program, if you like. I was program manager for, you know, a program that was running out of the Salvation Army and youth substance abuse services and things like that. So I was sort of combining this my own kind of journey with that sort of stuff. And I realized I wasn't happy doing that, that there was something kind of still in me that wanted to do something much more creative. And, you know, it's not that I didn't enjoy that work. And now that I was in my own sort of journey of recovery, it felt a bit too close to the bone. So I was talking to, it literally came out of conversation. And most of the things for me do come out of conversation. And that's why it's lovely to do this podcast, is that, you know, yet again, I found myself surrounded with artists, you know. And one of my friends had said to me, you know, why don't you just go to art school? Because I remember thinking, you know, I really want to go to art school. But now I was like the ripe old age of 35, you know, and I was sort of over the hill, so I thought. And, you know, and the first thing I thought was, though, because I said, well, I can't go to art school. Why not? I said, well, because first of all, you need qualifications. Now, this is how naive I was at this stage. You know, I'm from a working class family. Like, it was very, you know, working class. There wasn't really any sort of idea of going off and doing an education. You know, leaving school at 15 was perfectly, nobody really questioned it, you know. So it was a pinnacle moment when this person looked at me and said, you don't need qualifications to go to university at your age. I was like, right. And so what I did was I almost went back to college at that point. I decided very quickly, right, I need to work on a portfolio. And so I went to the Photographic Studies College, and it was still analog at that point, right? It was, you know, and you were still learning those techniques. And that was a great course for me. It was so grounding. I learned, as much as I didn't like a lot of the course, because they got you doing everything. You're out doing every single kind of genre of photography possible. But what happened during that course was I found a sort of mode of working that's kind of stayed with me. And it was a series of portraits that were, you know, shot on my FG20 in the garden with a tripod now, again, sort of like a proper tripod, not just a fence post, you know, and taking these portraits of just everyone I knew, but asking them to sort of remove any sort of codes or identifiers about who they might be sort of in the world. And this was the beginning of kind of really just trying to look closely at people, you know, and so the the camera was a lovely tool for me to kind of, whilst I was sort of getting intimate with people in a way with this, because I was getting close because I was using a 50 mil lens as opposed to a, you know, a portrait lens. So
Zoom.
The portrait lens, as you know, can flatten out things and there's a distance. And it wasn't until recently when I got a 50 mil for a portrait lens to do some commercial work, I just hated it because I felt so dishonest too, because I'm further back, but I'm so close to you through the lens and you don't know this. So it felt really voyeuristic for me, right?
Isn't it funny? Because I mean, look, I love a 50 and I love walking around the world with a 50, but the minute I sit with someone to take their portrait, I go to 100. Like, I love it. I move beyond an 80, which is, you know, your classic.
Yeah.
And it's like, I love coming right in because, I mean, I think what you said before was so beautiful, just, you know, to shed kind of identity markers and to just be able to be and sit with someone. But for me, I think the camera allows me to be even more intimately close because of the zoom, because of what? Not, I don't use it. I haven't. I'm lucky enough to have a prime 100, but you know, like,
yeah,
it is that amazing softness. And as you say, like, it gets rid of all perspective in there. It's all face.
Yeah.
You know, I just love a face, as I know you do too.
I do love a face.
But yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting about the lenses and lens choice. And as we both teach, you know, we're constantly talking about making the right decision for ourselves when you pick up a lens and when you are looking at a subject. And I think that's really fascinating about starting at a 50 and coming close. And yeah, it's very cool.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And that's what I continue doing. So needless to say, any commercial headshots I do, people don't actually like them because there's a distortion there. Right. And so I've had to work with, in terms of other work that I do, I have to work with, you know, the 80mm lens, and I don't like it, but I do it. But for my for my creative practice, there is something in that, you know, it's not something I'm trying to get. I'm not trying to get any essence here or anything, but there is something, you know, you're in person, you can. Yeah, it sounds almost creepy, but it's not creepy. You know, it's the. You
no,
know,
I know what you mean.
Yeah, and
I do know what you
and
mean.
And obviously, there's you know, through time and through, you know, opening up and learning so much. I learned so much in my first year at university when I finally got in. You know, so I got into art school and I just soaked it all up. This is a great thing about a kid who had no education into suddenly, I cannot get enough, you know? And art history for me was just mind-blowing. It just blew my mind. And I just kept having to pinch myself. I can't believe I'm here at university learning all this stuff.
Wow.
Why is nobody actually shouting and screaming with joy here? You know, everyone just looks so bored around me. And I'm like, I can't wait to get to the lecture, you know?
Yeah. No, you're just a nerd like me. I love it.
Oh, gosh. And so learning
and you
about,
kept going too.
Oh, like, I just couldn't
stop. You didn't just stop at the bachelor. You went bachelor, honours.
Yeah.
And then PhD, right?
Yeah, well, master's and PhD. So
you did master's as well.
Yeah.
Sorry, you did it all.
And
wow.
I didn't convert.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, I mean, there's a push to convert. I feel like there's a lot of push to convert. You know, I had a scholarship at that time for the master's, but it was a research master's, so I wasn't ready then to take it any further. I still had no idea what I was doing when I was doing my master's, even though I'm hardly doing really well, you know, in this crest of, you know, the bubble of the institution.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but, you know, I
let's talk about portraits, because I love your portrait work. And specifically, I first came across your work with your Teenage Tomboy series.
Yeah. So the Tomboy, I mean, the Tomboy actually started in my undergraduate. So, you know, how it came about was classic to, I think, a lot of us when we go to art school, especially women anyway, I would say, during this time, 2007, 2008, you know, I got immediately involved in sort of a feminist kind of framework, right? So thinking through those ideas about identity and what it means to be, you know, the woman in the world, the classic Simone de Beauvoir quote, you know, about the constructiveness of everything. And so I started to really look at that, and I made some really, you know, I was inspired by Cindy Sherman and the classic, right?
All the classics. I love
it. All the classics. Interestingly, I also love Golden, of course. You know, her work was so alive, almost the opposite to my work, like alive, present, immediate, you know. And I wasn't documenting my life during that time of mayhem and craziness because I was in it. So it's sort of like coming back to it later, always, you know, anyway, turning the lens on myself at that point. But as someone who was performing, so I was using the performativity in front of the lens. I was playing, I was, you know, dressing up and doing all these things. And that was a work called What the Fuck Are You Looking At? And What the Fuck Am I Looking At? You know, so there was sort of almost kind of punk attitude in my work early on, spray painting on the walls and standing in front of it and things like that. But what happened is that in 2008, I had a medical procedure that was actually life and death. Oh, so wow. It was a full-on, I won't go into it particularly, but it was a full-on experience where I had this tumor called a teratoma removed.
Okay.
And the teratoma tumor contained hair, teeth, blood, bone, skin, saliva, and a pancreas.
Oh my gosh.
And it was a huge problem, okay. Right? But the long and short of it was is that this happened during my the holidays in semester one at uni art school, right? And I went into hospital thinking, you know. And anyway, everything changed after that. Suddenly the things I was looking at, I started to see that I really need to turn the lens. I started thinking about my history, my life, rather than just sort of this masquerade, just get down, made it a bit more serious for me, yeah. You know. And at that point, I created these sculptural works, funnily enough, because that comes later again back into my work and video. And that's where the tomboy thing started, because I thought, well, I go back to the beginning. What was I doing when I was a kid? I was a tomboy. What does that mean? What is a tomboy today? You know, at this point, 2008. And I started by putting actual paste-ups on the wall, like little pictures all around North Fitzroy and those sorts of areas, because I was living in Collingwood at that point, saying, female artists looking for tomboys. I mean, it was so kind of, and it was meant to be a bit sort of tongue in cheek as well. I didn't expect anything. And then suddenly I get this phone call from this dad whose kid had saw this poster, ripped it off the wall, went home and said, that's me. Can you give, I want to do this. Because, you know, I was looking for them to photograph. So through this first kid who sort of felt self-identified, I am a tomboy. He was 8 years old, 9 years old. I started photographing these kids, and she had friends who were tomboys. And before you knew it, everyone was a tomboy, all coming out of the woodwork. And so I did this, you know, these first portraits, which were, again, loading up the image with kind of tropes and sort of these historical kinds of ways of the narratives of the tomboy. So the kid in the landscape with the dog, you know, the slight cheekiness, other tropes like, adventure, or, you know, definitely animals were in there. That was a big one, because a lot of the tomboys is this kinship with animals and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, because animals are just way easier to deal with.
That's right.
Yeah.
And there's this notion of the outsider, you know. So, but anyway, during that time, I started to then follow it through and think, okay, well, was I still a tomboy when I was in my teens? And that's when it sort of got interesting. I started to come across these theories. You know, Michelle Annabate talks about tomboy taming, you know, and it's this interesting word, because tomboy itself is an interesting word. There's a lot of different iterations of that word across time. Mm. And one of them is definitely linked to class and race, you know. So it's got these connotations to it. Class and race, because she's described at one point as a dark, ruddy-skinned girl who's out in the land or something. So the class element, of course, is that the opposite to the fair maiden in England at that point was the, the waif-like, fair-skinned, whatever. So there's definitely a link, there. And so obviously, and the tomboy in the narrative has always got dark hair and kind of curly and freckles. And, you know, so there's those racial undertones there, or overtones. But anyway, what the overarching sort of theme was that the tomboy is erased during, you know, at puberty. She has to conform in some way. It's also the sense of the body at that age is immediately objectified or sexualized in the girl body. You know, there's puberty happening. And the taboo really at the end of it is that we don't want girls to become butch. We certainly don't want them to be lesbians. This is not what I wasn't focusing on that at this point, because that was the aversion for me was still there. And I didn't realize it at this point.
Yeah.
I was not looking at it through that lens. I kept thinking, well, a tomboy doesn't necessarily mean that you grow up to be a lesbian. But of course, it's a perfect precursor for that. But I continued to not sort of look at sexuality, even though I was looking at my own history through others, through photographing tomboys now during adolescence. So again, I put a call out for girls who identified as tomboys, self-defined, obviously. But then, and that was in my honours work, you know, so I started to link it with sculptural works again. So doing these portraits, but then starting to bring in these others, so I started to photograph dead animal parts, you know.
It's sort of random.
Yeah, and there was like, these are like trophies. So the sense of, the idea is that the adolescent girl, tomboy, has now become a sort of trophy. Her body becomes a trophy. But then she herself has trophies,
yes.
You know. And so
okay.
There's this play with this sort of notion. So I created these, also these really, you know, by this point I'm working with digital. So they're very kind of, the clarity in them
so
is almost
clean,
intense,
right?
You know.
Yeah, and so crisp.
Yeah, and I'm working with, yeah. And I'm working in the studio with large format cameras and these sorts of things, medium and large, for certainly for the photographing the trophies. And I'm thinking about the tomboy again as sort of, you know, this notion of if you make it out of puberty and your tomboy sort of in this intact, then you're kind of like amazing, because there's a lot of push, you know, to sort of feminize and peer pressure and all these things. And especially at adolescence, because that's when sexuality starts to, you know, that's when we start exploring sexuality. And of course, during the 80s, when I was growing up, there was no, you know, you might have had Boy George and all that, but that was immediately overlaid with HIV and AIDS and this thing that we'll get onto, this other political landscape, which was happening during the 80s through, you know, a conservative Labour lobbying for a general election that was about to occur, and re-emergence of a clause that would ban homosexuality in schools. So that's another thing. But so that's what we'll talk about later with the PhD, I think. But yeah, back to the tomboy work. So that was the beginning of it, in terms of turning the work onto myself, but still not interestingly using, and then taking myself out of the picture at the same time. So I started to explore through others, of course, because I'm looking at children, I'm looking at tomboys, and I'm looking at adolescents. And then my master's project was, so let's open it all up. Like, who's a tomboy now? So let's look at tomboys from 14 to 75 or 80 or 100 or however old you
gotcha.
Are, you know. And it went up to 75 because that was the oldest kind of participant that I came across, that I encountered one day walking her dog. And got talking, and she said, "I'm a tomboy," you know. And the definitions, the storytelling started at this point too. The storytelling's
so
always been through my work as well, because the narrative is very important. And so, what also went along with those large scale portraits at that point, they turned the work back to how I was photographing again, with sort of no symbols anymore, no sorts of identifiers or anything. Just the face, and but the stories were each participant just said, right, so what does it mean to you to be a tomboy? And so these were the stories, and they were so interesting, you know, across the scale, and they were definitely generational, you know. Like the older woman was talking, Helen her name was, she spoke about how when she was younger, to wear army strides, they were called land army strides or something, was all she wanted to do, because everyone else, you know, she was brought up in the country and it was ridiculous she had to wear a skirt. So it was very sort of gendered and sort of simplistic in that way, but also it was about education, you know. She wanted to be, go to university, study agriculture, but she wasn't allowed as a woman in Australia at that point. And so, you know, that's sort of interesting. So the sense of having to be more masculine in the world to gain, you know, you know, ambition and things like that. And it would change. And of course, the word was cancelled as well. So there's that.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. But it's a fascinating topic for me. It still is. But I've been trying to move away from it.
I think it's still also very apt. I think I wonder, you know, I always feel like there are certain stories that sit with us, or, you know, like, or subject matter that will always be ours. And maybe it's, I think I said to someone recently, oh, yeah, I've been cultural identity chick for a very long time. And I think I always will be, you know, because that is kind of my story. You know, it's linked to me, even if I'm not like yourself. You know, you might not be talking about the personal, but it's coming from the personal because you've got this empathy and understanding and connection. And also you can recognize it in the world. We've set the scene quite nicely there in terms of the PhD. And I love the title, Evoking the Invisible Lesbian, you know, because it...
Through art.
It is being personal. Well, through art, yes. But like through photography and sculpture and installation and so many things. But, you know, it really does speak to broader narratives of lesbian identity across the globe, like not even just in Australia. Like I think you did turn the lens... or the camera onto yourself, and you're in a pretty intimate way, I think, in a very revealing, honest way that I think was quite brave and courageous.
Is this the dancing in the bedroom stuff?
Oh, but even the writing. Your writing is amazing as well, you know.
Definitely,
the
writing.
That's where we see your storytelling at its best. Or even the image of, you know, the old photograph of yourself, you know, that's pretty dark and very Nan Golden in a way, but also you. And I think PhDs can get you away from that sometimes, you know, like it can become theoretical and very, you get bogged down in justifying everything. But I think the refreshingness of your PhD, especially the writing, but also the work and experiencing the work, is that we get raw Leslie, I think. And I love that. and there's still humor in there and there's still artistry and beauty, but it's very raw. So if you don't mind, I think we should talk about that now. Mm.
The word raw is a very apt word, actually. I think that's the word it's the word I usually use. It's the word I couldn't find during this podcast, like a lot of words, because it's, you know. but yeah, the word raw is a good word. I think those early portraits that I was doing were exactly that. So... And, you know, just to say, I just want to give a shout out to my supervisors for continuously bringing me back to the work. Because you said about there's a propensity for us to go into the theory. And I did get bogged down with that. That's insecurity that does that. You know, I think, well, for me, it was, you know, somehow that. But then it becomes almost easier in a way to do it through a theoretical framework. For me, it was because it started to think, well, it's all here. Whereas when you're creating artwork, there's nothing there to begin with. And what are you going to do? You know, how can we write through the work that's not even really there yet? You know, and those sorts of things. So it's a very weird experience, PhD. But my PhD was activated through a couple of things, actually. But the first thing was really that, you know, although I'd been exploring, you know, ostensibly my own history through, you know, the sort of tomboy identity and these narratives, and then through portraiture and photographing other people, I also saw that, you know, a lot of the, especially from my honours supervisor at the time and my other supervisor, my master's supervisor, you know, there was always this sense of like, well, it doesn't necessarily, the tomboy isn't necessarily a precursor to becoming a lesbian. And I used to think, yeah, and I'd get embarrassed. You know, it was almost like I was, so I knew, and I started to see, I have internalized homophobia. Duh. You know, and so it's this sort of moment of going, oh my God, I am actually, as a woman now in her 50s, still, you know, say this word in a hush, still sort of frightened to look at it, because then suddenly it became obvious. It's sort of like, well, yeah, but, and it's such an obvious precursor. Here I am. I am for a kid to be grown up. It's an excellent segue into adult lesbianism, if you like, to sexuality. And I think what my PhD started to show me was that it's actually extremely problematic. You know, sort of coming back to the beginning of this talk, really, of the adolescent who's sort of, we're just, you know, we're oozing with sexuality and exploration at that stage, and how it could have been such a beautiful exploration, you know, all for all of those times and all of our lives, for all of our sexuality. And it's often fraught. And I think for myself, it was specifically fraught because, you know, there's this almost annihilation of this previous identity. There's nowhere to go with it. There's nothing to see. Suddenly, there's this, an absence of space there. And it's sort of, well, what now? What, how can I, you know, so I would, you know, yeah. And so it's a very baffling time, I think, for most of us. For me, I think damaging psychologically, there's a lot of sort of theory that I was interested in around that. And it makes sense to me. So I started to identify with this. I'm trying to, you know, sort of figure out my own relationship to my own sexuality now that I'm in my, you know, my 50s. And so that was the beginning. And the next thing was that, you know, I go to the Lesbian Archive in Glasgow, because the other thing is my work at this point was so heavily sort of rooted in Scotland. You know, I mean, I get really homesick a lot, you know, and I hearken to these, it's almost this back to the beginning again, where I'm out in, with the bike, you know, into these landscapes, you know, if you like, or whatever they are, they're sort of, whether they're old industrial sites or there's the sea there at the same time. So it's a bit like, it's almost a bit like, you know, the paddocks at Williamstown or Altona. Mm. It's those sorts of kinds of landscapes, very flat, bleak. But, you know, for me, that's
home.
You know, Agnes Varda talks about if we open up people, we'll find landscapes, yeah. You know. And if you open up me, you'd find a bleak landscape, you know. And that's not to say, you know, I often jump out of bed with joy in the morning, so don't get me wrong. But, you know, there is definitely a, that in me, like a weighted feeling of this longing for something, for home, wow. You know, which, you know, and it's also a palette, it's a tone, it's a mood. And I think this is what I capture in my work. But anyway.
Let's just stop there for a minute. I definitely say that that is what comes across in your work with people or with landscape, actually, which is fascinating.
There's
thinking
a northernness.
About that. There is a bleakness
is,
and a kind
right?
of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now that you say it, and you say it beautifully, and I actually think of Raymond Carver, who's one of my favorite writers.
I love Carver.
Also very bleak.
Yes.
But out of a longing is interesting.
But about suburban almost.
Yeah,
isn't
different.
It?
Very. But that idea of longing
it's
for
got that
something.
Sense.
And I think you get that actually across all of your work. There is a longing. There is a, or yearning maybe. I'd never thought about it as homesickness, but it's
I think it
actually.
Could be something as simple as homesickness, actually. Mm. You know, there's a, and not, let's not forget as well. I mean, obviously there's a romanticization.
Oh, sure. I mean, it's a complex
too,
thing, right?
Because there's,
I'm not,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Totally.
Yeah. We sort of the, and the other, and it's like, oh, it's all, but it is interesting. I've lived in Melbourne. I'm in denial about this for 26 years.
There you go.
Right,
so it's home,
and I've barely got a color photograph. Like, I mean, all my work's sort of black and white, and even the color is so desaturated, it's almost black and white. You know, it's sort of like, because that's how the landscape is here. So it's just a, there's no blue or there's no color in the sky, really. I mean, there is in November, but every other time it seems to just be flat. You know, the Beckers, they were a huge influence to my work.
Yeah, okay.
You know, whether it's photographing mills or landscapes or people. It's the same thing. It's the white flat sky. It's the flat light. It's, there's no, you know, it's not direct sun. It's not any of these things. But anyway, so yeah. And so that's something that is inside of me that comes out through my photographs, definitely, and through my sculptural works, actually. But so back to this gap or this invisibility in my PhD, which is evoking the invisible lesbian. So not only, you know, am I not finding myself in my work, kind of literally, right? But also figurative, well, literally in terms of sexuality. So I start to think, okay, what is a lesbian? How is it that I still say that word and sort of want to trip over it? It's a funny word as well, right? Let's face it. But I'm still laughing as if I'm a child. But I go to the Lesbian Archive and I specifically say, I want to find photographs of tomboys and lesbians from the 1980s to 1990s Edinburgh. The more specific I thought, just do it. Why not go for it, you know? So I set this up before I left. It was all, you know, it was all supposed to be all happening. So I go there and there's loads of boxes laid out and I'm like, oh, great. You know, and I couldn't wait to get into them. I could not find a single photograph or of a lesbian or a tomboy, whatever that is, right? So this wasn't any representation there. It was ephemera, direct, you know, snapshots or anything, or even publications.
Wow.
What there was though, was reams and reams of newspaper clippings that that were a representation through the press, through the paparazzi press in the UK at that time. We're talking, slur. And so the representation was of the activism that was happening around this clause that had been reintroduced into Parliament during that time. And this was in the early 80s, this started to emerge, and it coincided with HIV and AIDS. That was the catalyst for it. And it was also intersected a sort of a political, fight, really, between the Labour and the Conservatives. Thatcher had been in for quite a while, and the landscape in the UK was changing dramatically. And it was a very dark time. But when you're growing up in it, you don't really know, if you like. You're in it. Mm. And I'm in Leith, which, remember, is a small place. It was very small, very, out of the loop, if you like. I mean, I'm 50. I'm not really thinking about it, So a lot of this is happening in London. But it was interesting to go through all of this information, start to go, oh, my God, it's no wonder I have this aversion to, a large part of myself, my sexuality, in this term, because that's why. And so that was interesting. So that got me thinking just more as this sort of, so I made some great work in paste ups around that in Melbourne through all sorts of stuff, like Moreland City Council commissioned this sort of work. That was before it was Mary Beck. Sorry, it's Mary Beck now. Perfect. But this is all happening during sort of COVID, where these sorts of works started to go up as paste ups because they couldn't,
we couldn't
be realized in what they were going to be. Yeah. And, but anyway, that was the sort of political intent of it, just to kind of make this history visible, if you like, over there, and how it's been constantly repeated, actually. And certainly now is an interesting time. But that's only a really small, that's a section of the work. And the other part was just to explore this gap. It's no surprise that there's no representation there. I mean, there might have been, so don't get me wrong, it's not a slur on the institution like the Lesbian Archive or Glasgow Women's Library, which do an incredible work, and the history of that, I won't go into it of time, but it's just incredible. But it's that they might not have been sorted or vetted or, or those sorts of things.
But also,
but it does raise those questions, doesn't it?
I wonder too if it, like, it's a personal archive. What you're pointing to here is that representation happened behind closed doors, in the closet. It happened, on small cameras in private settings. So of course there isn't the potential,
the ephemera,
there isn't the evidence,
things.
Because it actually to be done silently, quietly, privately. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's so interesting because that's going to take me to what my next project, which I'm excited about. But, So then I started to just think about, invisibility literally as a sort of, as an opposition in a way, not as an opposition, but as another other way of looking at things, I suppose, outside of direct representation. Mm. And so, Catherine Opie's work, of course, in the 90s,
totally.
Incredibly important, amazing work, and still is. It's like, whoa, right? So direct representation through portraiture, obviously, I've tried to do that myself in a sense, but is incredibly important. But, I really wanted to move away from portraiture as well. And all through my work, there's been landscape. Absolutely. Like I did this one, The Metaphorical Tomboy, which was another body of work, which was just all iced over landscapes, again, in Scotland on one of my trips. So I'm sort of returning. And also I'm interested in, like, if I'm going to be drawn on this historic, so to put myself into this character, if you like, as this tomboy protagonist, this teenager now who's grown up during this time and trying to really kind of conjure that or evoke that. So I'm being in spaces that I used to, I've woke up in blackouts in as well, because there's also this history of drunkenness, right? We can't get away from that. So this, during this time of kind of trying to find ourselves in this, through this sort of political landscape, social landscape, there's a lot of shame around it. So a lot of the queer world was happening underground and, or in sort of hidden little areas, and you didn't really know where they were, and, and then the shame aspect. So sort of hiding from it through literal landscapes like the fog, which is where I grew up in Edinburgh. It's everywhere. And also the fog of drunkenness and the fog of memory in time, you know. So this all started to come into this PhD. And so it was sort of like almost laying out, it's a semi-autobiographical text. It seems very autobiographical, but I think it's also, you know, filling in the gaps, right, as well. And it's a way of kind of writing myself through it, through these sort of really evocative, those sorts of narratives, you know, and these images. So to try and evoke the sense, if you like. And I don't know how that works in terms of direct representation. It doesn't. So it's,
I don't think it needs to.
You can get whatever
though.
You want from that work.
I don't think it,
no, it doesn't
need
it doesn't.
To, I think. I mean, I guess my question there is, do you think you're trying to claim the gaps also, like bring them into consciousness, but also own them in a way as yours?
Yeah, there's something in this invisibility about, because, you know, the irony of it was that I was never invisible as a lesbian, if you like, right? If we're going to go back to a literal route, because it was so obvious. But I was invisible to myself, right? Well, and so you deny it. So that's upon invisibility. And also now as a middle-aged woman, I was, you know, the paste-ups aspect to the current work, you know, which is, well,
yeah,
the PhD work, I've done a lot of paste-ups. But
your current show is called The Invisible Lesbian, that's on at the moment in Edinburgh, right?
Yeah, so I've got a current exhibition on which brings the work sort of home. The idea was to bring it full circle. And so I've done a sort of, you know, I haven't shown in Edinburgh before, my hometown, you know. So everyone's very proud of me here.
Excellent.
You know what I mean? I sort of
That's
go
very
off
nice.
Into the... but yeah, so creating a selection of works, but expanding on it as well. So it's sort of building on the broadsheet, which was part of the PhD, which was the paste-up work, chapter two, I think. So activating the streets to sort of get some sort of traction, you know, and also emulate this sort of quick way of getting the work, getting something out there, a message out there by using the streets, you know. And so the posters that I've put around Edinburgh, The Invisible Lesbian, are written in a word play. So you can't actually see what it says almost. So it's still sort of invisible, right? And I've had so much attention for these posters.
Wow.
Like by lesbians who are... You know, and everyone really, but particularly lesbians coming to the show who have said to me, you know, they see it right away. I show my dad it and he's like, I don't even know what that says. And I'm like, of course you don't.
It's not for you, Dad.
And then, you know,
sorry.
People are like, is it French? Is it written in French or something? You know, like, because it's le les and then bien at the end. But yeah, so I had, getting back to this sort of, you know, how it's still sort of important today, the tomboy thing. And even I think, well, is it important today that, you know, talking about invisibilities and lesbians and this sort of stuff, right? It's sort of like, you know, it's my history and I'm getting it out there. But also I was surprised by young women, 25, 20, because I'd be asking them, how old are you? You know, because they're coming into the show and they're going, I can't believe that I saw that poster. I got off the bus. I took a picture of myself, a selfie with the poster, and then I was conscious of doing that and felt embarrassed about being seen taking myself, a picture of myself in front of this poster.
That's fascinating.
And then one fascinating one was this woman who was 25. And so she presents as quite sort of femme, you know, we have this butch femme dynamic and everything in some areas of queerness and being a lesbian. I suppose it's sort of historical, but it still very much exists. And for that's the other sort of invisible lesbian, if you like, someone who presents like everyone else, like, or something like with long hair or whatever, whatever, right? These silly ways that we sort of identify people, which we all do because this is the imprint. Anyway, so she would present as that and she said, I'm invisible. I don't really know how to meet other women, right? And so she's been living in London, and even in London, I'm like, that is incredible. She said, yeah, I ended up wearing this little ID bracelet with gay written on it. And she said it worked because people would start talking to me. And I was reminded of this lovely, you know, we're talking about coming full circle, just things continuing. In the 1940s, women in, you know, in America and the UK would tattoo these little blue nautical stars on their wrists, small, and wear the watch strap over it. And we'd reveal it to if they thought that you might be another lesbian. And it was a way of kind of codifying and saying, this is me, to identify one.
Wow.
Another. Because,
yeah,
you know,
it was unspoken, and just, right?
Yeah. But anyway, I thought that was lovely. So the interest with that, it showed me that this is still very much, you know,
It's relevant. There seems to be a lot of momentum today amongst young people, because especially young lesbians, because they're moving away from digital spaces. They want to meet people in real life. And this is in Edinburgh. Well, I haven't taken it to Melbourne yet. And so they have these newsies called, say, Dyke News or, you know, Dyke Bar or something. It's very much a return in a way, but now. And so for these people who are creating these spaces, I was like, well, what? And they said to me, the interesting thing about you, this is that we still don't see the word lesbian. And so that's what we're drawn to here, because we understand that there's still this word's loaded and we tend to whisper it. So the project that I'm in the middle of sort of proposing at the moment, and I've already speaking to spaces over here, particularly the Women's Library, to try and bring this archive back, is to have this project where I invite, first of all, it was going to be women from the 80s and 90s who identify as lesbians who were grown up, you know, in urban areas during the 80s and 90s. Maybe they've moved to rural areas now, I don't know. But anyone, really, everyone and everyone, to come to send me photographs of themselves, but also to have an actual workshop, a big workshop within the library, and bring a photograph with you, right?
Yes.
And then create this massive installation of these photographs, just like a big bombardment of images, and, you know, obviously document that. But then at the end, we take these images and we put them into the archive.
Fantastic.
And so we have now an abundance of pictures.
Oh my gosh, I love that idea. That is just so incredible. So
yeah, and exactly. So women then, women now, everyone. So yeah, I just think it's a really lovely way to bring it back and to broaden it out too, you know, because I'm sort of desperate a wee bit to broaden out the work as well, which, you know.
I think the thing that I love.
So I think that would be a lovely collective.
Yeah, I think it would be a lovely project, but also there's an activism in that too. And I think, and a kind of correction to that gap again, but also going back to that initial thing of, you know, all those boxes and you being so excited to open all those boxes and then just, you know, news cuttings. Like, also giving all those lesbians a distinct community home in history. And I think that is really important.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have that. I'm constantly thinking about, especially in photographic history, it's women are not always represented. Women of color are not always represented. Clearly lesbians aren't represented. You know, how do we do this?
Yeah.
I mean, yes, we have to do the labor. I always get a bit, you know, like, oh, here we go. We have to correct it. But I also think that gives us agency and that gives us power, because we can choose the images and we can add the stories and we can actually represent something that is honest. You know, if we go back to that idea of the raw image and you on your bike with the Walkman, you know, in a way.
Yeah.
If you could put that picture of you in the archive, I mean, how fantastic, right? And you're giving that opportunity to many, many people to actually think about what's the image that they would like to have go of them or of their community go down in history, which is pretty amazing. So how exciting.
Yeah, that's right. And so, and what's, yeah, because I don't know what life it will take. This is why I think it's important, if we can, to bring people in real life. Mm. So whether they bring a picture of themselves or not, you know, maybe we take a picture of us now or
whatever.
Yeah, so
version,
it has the potential.
Right. Yeah.
And the thing I love about this is it's got a humility to it that I really like. You know, it's sort of being back in Edinburgh for this, you know, I've been here since April and I've been just very engaged in a lot of sort of things locally. Mm. And it feels so, I don't want to use the word grassroots, but it's definitely got that rootedness to it. I mean, people here are very Scottish in a way. I mean, there's a lot of people, you know, at my show, there were people I hadn't seen for 30 years,
Wow. You
know, this group of band of lesbians, you know, that all sort of came out of the woodwork to the show and things like that. But there's a lovely, there's something here that's very grounding and calming for me within the practice. And so to do a project like this, it feels, you know, it doesn't feel like my project in a way, you know, and I think that's what I'm sort of enjoying about the aspect of it. I've not really got a sort of sense of me as an artist attached to it in any way. But yeah, the posters have been
have probably given me so much exposure for this project and taken it forward. And, you know, I just think that'll be a resolve to it. And then I can move on to other things, you know, because, yeah.
Fabulous.
Celebrating the word.
And, yeah. And just maybe just having a word. I mean, currently you are wearing the Invisible T-shirt, which I love. unfortunately, viewers can't. Yeah, I mean, we can't view it on podcast, but maybe one day it will just say lesbian, you know? maybe. But what an amazing conversation and journey we have gone through tonight. Thank you. Like, I love listening to you talk and I love hearing about how you navigate through the ideas, but also your personal journey through. And I absolutely adore your work. So thank you for making the time tonight.
Very welcome. Thank you, Pia, for having me.
Out of the Frame is supported by RMIT University Press Play Studio, is produced by Pia Johnson, music by Steph O'Hara, and graphic design by Brent Leadovitz.